I'm John Beck, and it's my pleasure to co-direct our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives. And as I was saying to Les, you know, this is really my guilty little pleasure. I've got a couple others that I won't mention, but this happens to be a major one for me. Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives brown bag series has been around for 16 years, and this year has been, I think, unbelievable so far. You know, kind of just amazing talk after amazing talk after amazing talk. Today will not break that record, I can promise you. But let me do a couple of announcements. As usual, let me first of all tell you that next Friday, in this very room, Lori Summers, who is a wonderful folklorist, is going to be talking about Brotherhood of the Lake, Commercial Fishing, Work, and Livelihood in Leland's Fish Town. For any of you who have been up in the Traverse City area, I'm sure that you've been at Fish Town in Leland. And Lori has been working on that as a consultant to the Fish Town Preservation Society on a major kind of study of Fish Town. So I think you'll find that to be of interest. So please feel free to take one of those and give them to friends and family. I'll also send around the rest of the fall schedule. We have all sorts of wonderful things on the fall schedule, so please feel free to take one of those. Many of you have already signed in. If you haven't signed in, please do. It's always great to know who's here, and we really, really care about that, by the way. The exhibit of Les's photographs will be up at the MSU College of Law on the fourth floor through December 15th, so please do get over there to see the photographs. You'll see some of them today, but there's nothing quite like seeing them in that setting, and since some of them are very large and really quite striking. Let me just announce that on November 16th, Randy Croce made a film called If Stone Could Speak, which is also on the Barry Vermont Stone Sculptors, and that film will be shown in the Castle Boardroom at the College of Law, which is on the third floor, so you can see the exhibit and then see the film. And that's going to be at 7 o'clock on the 16th, which is a Wednesday night. I want to introduce Chris St. John from Jackson, who's a member and especially a board member of the Michigan Monument Builders. They were nice enough to underwrite this exhibit and Les's visit to campus. So we can't thank Chris and the rest of his board members enough. Said he couldn't stay away after meeting Les yesterday and come today. So with that, I'm going to maybe bow that down just a little bit. We'll turn down the volume and let me introduce Les Bartlett. And I want to, by way of introduction of Les, have everyone see my good friend Ron Carver. Ron was a brown bag speaker in this series a year ago or so. And we had an exhibit of Ron's photographs of mothers and daughters down at the ground level gallery. And it's wonderful to have Ron as one of my lifelong friends. But Ron introduced me to the whole notion of bringing Les in. So, and he surprised Les by flying in early for some meetings he has to attend from the Washington, D.C. area to be able to be here. So thanks, Ron, for coming in and for making sure that Les Bartlett was here with us. So with that, let me hand this mic back to Les, and he can hook himself up. And Les Bartlett has an unbelievable story about himself that hopefully will come through this lecture in terms of his own personal background, falling in love in his native New England with the Barry stone, which is rock when it's in the quarry and stone when it rises above the lip of the quarry. And he has been a performer. He is a professional photographer. He has done a variety of things in his life. I'm sure that these will come out. But today, he's joining us at our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives to talk about Give Me Your Hands, the Legacy of the Barry Stone Sculptors and Their Stone. So please join me in welcoming Les Bartlett.
Thanks. How do we put this on?
Like downtown.
Sound check okay? Wonderful. All right. So it's very appropriate to begin a topic on hands and the dedication of the sculptors to hands to share with you what was a lifelong passion for me with my hands, which is for 30 years, and I'll show you some of the slides shortly, I juggled professionally on stage with a stage magic company. And I began at the age of 19 where I went to a friend and I said, how do you juggle? And he picked the balls up and I picked them up and I started juggling. Well, for a long time, this is how I juggled. I would look at the balls and they would go. And then slowly, over time, I developed the ability to not look at the balls and to be able to do all kinds of little things without really looking at them. And this kind of thing brought me to, just as I am now, introducing a theatrical setting where there might be between 50 and 800 people. So for a very long time, I got comfortable with my hands going out like this. But the entire time, there were these objects, these balls, occupying the space in between. It brought a great sensitivity for me to people who worked with their hands in a variety of forms and careers. So it was very natural when I ran into the sculptors to see that they had a similar great intent. So today there's this great mystery where we are used to seeing people and politicians and the hands going out. Okay? I want to bring them back in. And ultimately, if I succeed at the end, there will be a moment of about 2 minutes on silence on the screen that will be hopefully opening for you to your hearts a little bit as they have been for me. So with this, one of the great sources of inspiration for me was I began as a Greek and Latin major in college for 2 years and decided I wanted to keep the poetry and not the academic side. But I became very fond of a Greek poet named George Seferiades. And Seferiades wrote a great poem. He was a Nobel Prize winner in literature. And a great poem of him begins with a repetition of Dos mu takeria su. Dos mu takeria su. Dos mu takeria su. And that translates very simply as, give me your hands. Give me your hands. Give me your hands. And the poem is the search of contemporary archaeologists going back into Greece, looking at ancient statues, looking to find the touch of a king on the stone sculpture. So I'm going to introduce you to this idea of how rock becomes stone and how the stone at the hands of the master sculptors becomes an extraordinary testament to the hands, as in any craft, moving from dream into will into art. And with that, we can have the lights come down perhaps a little bit in order to begin here. Okay. As I see where I am. The topic of Give Me Your Hands, the legacy of the Berry sculptors and their stones, has been a 4-year project for me. But the origins go much further than that. I discovered that Victor Hugo, when he was exiled from France, went to the Jersey Isles. And he fell in love with two new topics, two new passions. He fell in love with photography, and he fell in love with rock. And although he took many photographs himself, because he was not permitted to publish, we've never seen those. But he had his son Charles take photographs of himself in the rocks. And he proceeded to write poems on the mystery and the power of rock. He said, "Nothing changes shape like clouds, except for rock." This is one of my more recent images. Nothing changes shape like clouds, except for rock. And it's very emblematic of what my effort has been and passion with rock and stone and what Hugo's was. This shows the connection of a sculptor's hand with the rock directly. This is a plaster cast from 1946 of the working hand of René Pisano, who taught in Barrie, Vermont. It's a unique signature of the Italian sculptors that many of them would do a plaster cast, at least one plaster cast, of their working hands. Most of these men labored in anonymity. At the simplest, they were doing a copyist tradition of maintaining a tradition of religious work, of monument work, where the individual was not praised, it was the execution of a continuous art form. They're taking their hand and making a plaster cast as a personal statement. And this follows through the tradition into Barrie. And there are two traditions that I'm going to be speaking to that exist. The American tradition, represented by Frank Gaylord, who came at a time in 1950 when the monuments were really at a dying art at that moment. The masters had come in the early 1900s. They were all dead. Gaylord comes from Philadelphia and opens his studio up to train other sculptors. It was a very savvy marketing move. By putting other people in competition, more people would come, more commissions would come to his door. And the remaining masters, and there are about six or seven Americans in the Barrie area, were all pupils of Gaylord. You might know in Washington, D.C., there's a great bronze execution of the Korean War Veterans Monument. It's a platoon of 19 soldiers. It's Gaylord's design, commission, and execution in art. The counterpoint to the American tradition is the one remaining sculptor from Carrara, Italy, Giuliano Cecchinelli, who first came over to the United States in 1959, worked with his father in Proctor. His father had come over when they wanted to extend the Capitol steps in Washington. There was no one in the United States that could do it. So Cecchinelli's father and a group of other marble workers came over, and Giuliano followed shortly thereafter and then moved to the Barrie area in 1965. This is a plaster cast of his left hand. What is unique about Cecchinelli, and you will see in the next series of slides, is that he does a plaster cast of his working hand in 1964, 1984, and then again in 2004. So he has recorded the conditions of his hand over some 40, 50, 60 years. It's extraordinary. It also demonstrates his attitude toward the art, which is not so much as art, but just as something that he does working with his hands. I would use the word ordinary pursuit, but not an ordinary result. So the next piece is a 3-minute video, and I'm going to talk through it, of just some of the key parts of the hands that I've come to. And it's very slow. It's meant not to look at hands like this, and to wash our hands of it, but to slow down a bit. That's me. So the first three images are the plaster hands of Giuliano Cecchinelli. A good counterpoint by the Carillion bells. He's a true patriarch of the Italian tradition of apprenticeship with your father, apprenticeship with the art school. At the age of 22, this is the first granite sculpture that he does. Every image looks as granite, as high relief. It was exuberance that allowed him to go into high relief on that. It was unheard of. Many of the master sculptors follow the tradition of doing a clay model and a plaster model. When I got the opportunity to begin this project, the Vermont Granite Museum gave me a list of sculptors to go see. And they asked me to go see John Hanna first because he was dying. And I had the privilege of spending a half a day with him. I'll come back to that. These are the hands of Eric Holberg. I had a minimum of 15 minutes with these sculptors, up to 2 days with them, to photograph their hands. And the master sculptors, if you look here, you'll see when they move their hands, they're not looking out at us. They're looking at the space between their hands. Their occupation is so vitally connected. And you can see Cecchinelli's left hand. He's telling me that for 50 years he's worked never wearing a glove outdoors. Another signature of the sculptors is that when they touch a stone, they never touch it flat. There's always air. There's always the meeting of them to the floor, to the breath of the stone. To a sculptor, the stone is alive. Of Jerry Williams, who was one of the pupils of Frank Gaylord. Jerry's in his early 60s. This is not a young man's game, and mostly it is a man sculptors that I've encountered. Carvers work with women and ladies as well, but the strength required and the dedication comes down to men, who you would think is being big hulks, being strong, but have tremendous sensitivity in their hands. This was actually a signature piece, the hands of Eric Holberg. Eric suffers from Raynaud's syndrome, the degenerative nerve disease from the pounding. And when he is not using the tools or eating with a fork and knife, he is always working his hands to get sensation back into them. This is the hand of Frank Gaylord. Frank is the only sculptor that I've encountered that would gesture with a single hand. Well, that leads me to today and this wonderful topic. And so I do need to pause and give a great deal of acknowledgement to Michigan State University Law School, to John and to Nick, to the Michigan Monument Builders, to my dear friend Ron. There's another great line from Seferiades. He says, Ron, I've just met the monument builders last night, and Ron comes in, and I, like, ignore them. I merely fall on the floor, you know, because I wasn't expecting to see you. And there's this great line from Seferiades. He says, this breath of life is not ruled by transition. It's ruled by a thunderbolt. And so much of my span and time with being with quarries has been one burst of light in the midst of stone after another. So seeing Ron here last night and the bridge in order for me to be here was a great event. You know, I have to give a great event to the design people for the poster and the panel, because it would have been very easy and wonderful to have the photograph of the studio, the photograph of the hands. But what they did, whether by choice or by instinct, was to include this wonderful segment of the rock. And the relationship to rock and stone, and we're at a distance from it, although we're actually closer than what we think, because below us is the granite. And it is a single granite dome from Arcadia in Booth Bay, Maine, all the way out to Yosemite. So that stripping away the building, stripping away the grass, and one hell of a pounding reverberation reverberates. So this is a reverberation of the Barry sculptors, of an immigrant pattern of sculptors who come in the late 1880s to Barry because there's work. There's money to be made. They think that they're going to be able to make enough money to bring their family over to go back to visit, a very classic kind of immigration pattern. And they're coming by the hundreds, and they're dying by the hundreds because the very thing of stone that they're working with, the silica dust from it, is killing them. And as pneumatic tools, as steam tools come in, and the production has gone up and in demand, it was very typical by 1900 for a Berry worker who'd worked for 5 to 10 years and gone back to their Italian village to be dead within a year. By 1910, the average life expectancy of anyone working with stone and berry was 16 to 20 years less than the national average. This is, as part of my day with Cecinelli, he took me into his studio. And this is a studio that has contemporary maquettes and plasters and models of what he was working with. It also includes tools and instruments from the 16th century, literally from the 16th century, they'd brought from the art school in Carrara. So this was a treasure trove, and I just knew that I just had the photographic at that moment. So I'm delighted that it's part of the signature. Well, although this is about Berry, now I need to back up to my tradition a little bit. And the juggling was done in this vista, which is the Cabot Street Cinema Theater in Beverly, Massachusetts, where for 30 years I would stand down front, as I did just briefly at the beginning. And then during the show, I would be in costume as a jester, juggling. And in addition to juggling on stage, there were many venues we went to. Here I'm juggling at the White House in the East Room for a Christmas. This is back, I guess, in 1982 for all of the children of the diplomats that were in attendance. So a part of, and here I am back on stage, I'm on the left with two dear friends on the right. This is a routine that I developed for, literally I taught 3 generations, including my son, to juggle. And what this brought was a great sense of service, and I think this is something that I responded to in finding the way that the sculptors would work. While this was going on, I was living in Rockport in Cape Ann. And Cape Ann is an island north of Boston. I fell in love with the quarries. This is a freshwater quarry on the Atlantic Ocean. It's a state park. It's a rarity to find a quarry in that kind of environment. And I became interested, from a historical point of view, in the history of quarrying, and started to find that this was quite unique, that this was an island where the corporate headquarters for the Granite Company was located on the island itself. And they shipped a lot of paving stones. Right? So that led me into looking historically at the quarries, and then going in to begin to photograph them. And I was enjoying myself in 2000 and 2001 photographing them when we began to experience a 2-year drought. So if you see over on the left the kind of the railroad line or the road coming down, after a year and a half, this is a sunrise photograph where the quarry has dropped down 85 feet. And I've been going in to photograph and document. And I would be getting historical photos of equipment that was left. It encouraged me to continue to photograph through the winters. I developed a reputation for going out on the quarry ice when it would be frozen in the wintertime to get more interesting views. And what had been documentarian, this is an old stone sled that had not been seen for some 35 years, moved from documentarian into a more fine art and artistic effort. And I began to track the weather and the seasons in the quarries of Cape Ann. Started to get other people interested. And as I went along, ultimately I was invited and had the chance to have a 4-month show entitled Chapters on a Quarry Wall at the Cape Ann Museum in a room that was 50 by 50. It was up for 4 months and over 2,500 people attended it. With a 3-year ramp up, I was able to prepare some really kind of exciting things. These are 5 quarry images of the same quarry space, spring, summer, fall, winter, spring. Each image is 20 inches by 80 inches in height. Well, here's a general view of what the museum space looked like. So with that, I started to get introduced to people across the United States who are working with quarries and with stone. And they said, go to Berry, Vermont. You need to go to the Vermont Granite Museum and introduce yourself. So I went with this kind of a representative, and this is a piece that is up in the exhibit over at the law school. You don't get it here. If you get the chance, if you haven't seen it, you will want to touch it and think that it's 3D or that I've done something to make it 3D. We're all used to seeing the Grand Canyon and seeing slot canyons and seeing Yosemite, where the grandeur is far away and the plains just kind of flatten out. This is about an intimate immensity. I'm 20 feet away, I'm in the water, I'm 5 feet away, I'm standing on rock 10 feet away. It's a very old environment that I was in photographing for some 10 years. I go to Barrie, Vermont, and this is in the exhibit as well. And instead of the bright colors that are given to me from the seaside and from salt air and vegetation, I've got what was known as midnight dark horse granite, light and medium black granite, because of the high contrast in the surfaces between black and white. This is interesting. And I'm given a tour by the Vermont Granite Museum curator of the oldest quarry in the United States, Wells Lamson. It opened in 1812, closed in 1994, had an operating depth of 484 feet dry. This is multiple acre view that we're looking at. And I went on this whirlwind tour, and I started to do art, as I had done in Cape Ann. All the while the curator says, look, when the quarry people see, when the sculptors see your work, they're going to cry, because this is a working granite environment. I knew nothing about Barrie. Been there, driven by it once as a kid. And so she takes me on this tour of the quarries, and you know, I start to do art from the Barrie quarries. I'm introduced to Hope Cemetery. Hope Cemetery is a National Historic Landmark. There are over 10,000 stones in it. There are two unique characteristics about Hope Cemetery. Every piece of granite is from Barrie, and only people from Barrie are buried there. And it illustrates, you know, it was difficult enough that the sculptors came over knowing that they were getting pounded by the silicosis dust and that their employers were not going to move until the 1930s before they finally capitulated. But it would be one thing if it was a minor sideline that they were working in, but anywhere in the world, even today, if you want to do a granite sculpture, you ask for Barrie stone. It is simply the best granite. People from Westerly, Rhode Island will make claims as well, and it's equally pretty good, but the Barrie stone is de facto the best and most consistent stone. So that meant there's a high demand that's been there forever for Barrie granite. And I learned in Hope Cemetery that because it was the same granite across 200 years of monument work, that every attitude toward life and death was being present. And so this is from an early, very early part of the cemetery. I should add that Cecchinelli is the de facto expert on Hope. He knows every stone, like a librarian knowing every book in demand and every rare book and every page. And so we actually made about 3 hours worth of visits. Because at this particular, what you're looking at here is a great symbiology of reflecting who the person was, what time of year they died. Certain flowers indicated either a fulfillment of a life or a brokenness of a life. And they don't do that anymore. No one would pay for this type of work being done. At the same time, as time goes on, there were more, what might seem to be more whimsical choices for monuments. This is another piece by Cecchinelli. Again, single piece of granite. This is not limestone, it's not soapstone, it is not marble. It's granite that's been made to be given this soft finish. This happens to be Cecchinelli's grandfather, who was an airmail pilot and delivered the mail by air. And so to honor him, Cecchinelli did this carving where the pilot's in the plane, so on. The magnitude of the art came about because most of these sculptures were done on a pre-need basis. And this is a contemporary piece for the Pontagoni family. And Ronald and his wife, Mary, were both born in 1943. And the dash is just waiting for the completement of life on this plane. And this is a rarity right now to have a stone like this. This is what was a de facto standard for the master sculptors at the turn of the century. They were all doing sculptures that were going to be done, that would be simply all ready to be popped in the ground. And it meant that there was a degree of artistry and time that could be put into it that is no longer the case. And the fact is that the sculptors were fighting silicosis all the time. I was telling John this story, so I'm going to need to repeat the story of this statue. This was done by a sculptor. And he said, I have made this great monument that commemorates the moment of a stone sculptor dying from silicosis. But this sculpture is not to be revealed until I am in the ground and dead. And I have placed a nurse attending the sculptor. So the sculptor dies. Now, right behind where this plot of land is, where this monument is going, is another plot of land. And when the sculpture is revealed, the people gasp because it's not really a nurse, it's his mistress. You only get a little bit of the swell of the breast, but from the back you see these swelled buttocks. It's very sexy. And the doctor who's alive says, I'm selling my plot. I'm moving my pre-need statue to Florida because I'll be damned if I'm going to spend the rest of eternity looking at that woman's buttocks. Right? So, and that's the way that they looked at life and death. One of the master owners of one of the granite quarries, over 30 years, as the stone was coming out, would say, boys, put that piece over there. That's going to be from my mausoleum. And he bought 2 acres of land around him so no one would be anywhere close to him. Right? When they go to make the mausoleum, the granite is so perfect that when the columns sit on the base, they don't need to put mortar in it. They're perfect. Unfortunately, in Barrie, the city regulations were they didn't want columns falling over, so they were told they had to mortar it. They had to chisel artificial gaps in it in order to put the mortar in. The story about the mistress is what is the common story. What's extraordinary in this that I've come across in looking at it is these are the hands of a stone sculptor. I have yet to see any piece of art, painting, drawing, or sculpture where when there is a stone sculptor there, he doesn't have the tools in his hand. So this is a true moment of despair, okay, of what the conditions were like. When the Italians come, they're largely socialist and anarchist. They're very well organized. They're unionized. From their own funds, they build the Barrie Union Labor Hall, where they would meet beginning at the turn of the century. One of the more noteworthy events that you may or may not know about, in the 1913, the Bread and Roses strike in Lawrence, Mass., when there was a lot of violence, 73 of the children of the workers were transported to Barrie, and they lived in the Union Hall. You know, the Union Hall had, and Randy's film shows this quite well, they had their own food store. They had a real market. That was a real. They had their own insurance capabilities. This is now a National Historic Landmark. You can see down by the steps sandbags. What happened on Memorial Day is very tragic. Barrie had flash floods, and they had 8 feet of water come into the town, and 6 feet of water went into the basement, and it destroyed the elevator, destroyed the walls. They're faced with like a couple of $100,000 worth of repairs that they have no idea where it's going to come from. I spoke last fall at a play called Monuments Come Alive in the Barrie Historic Labor Hall, where there was a play done with 12 of the stones from Hope Cemetery being brought to life. High school students had learned the part, talking about it. I gave the introductory lecture, which was actually a first introduction of this topic back to Barrie. The threat of silicosis being ever present, this is a clay model done by Cecchinelli there's a statue in downtown Barrie of the Italian sculptor. Little frumpy hat, apron, tools, tool chest by his feet. Cecchinelli had been invited to submit a commission and was also part of the jurying committee. When he found out that it was going to be owned by the Italian-American Club, he said, no statue, no work of mine is going to be owned by any Italian-American Club. It wasn't so much Italian-American Club, it's just the idea was going to be owned by someone else. Okay? This is what he was working on as a submission. It shows the sculptor sitting, working on the block, and his hammer has been interrupted by the figure of death. It's certainly more striking than what's there. I don't know if it had moved beyond this, whether they would have really accepted it or not. Okay? This is a really good indication of what Cecchinelli was like. So I've been introduced to the quarries. I've been introduced to hope. And I hear that there are these many left master sculptors. There's a handful of master sculptors left, and they're dying. So I say, I've got a great idea. I want to do this project called Give Me Your Hands. And since they all used to do traditionally monuments based on pre-need, I'm going to go to the sculptor and say, gee, why don't you take a position of how you would like your monument to be? And I'll photograph you in that. It was an airy idea, okay? And it was airy because the board of directors makes up the list of people they want me to go see, and I go to see John Hanna. And John Hanna had not worked for 6 years, had not been in his studio for 6 years. He was about to die in 3 months. He had a friend there because he thought I might have been an insurance. He had no idea. He said, yes, come, and he didn't know what I was there for. Short-term memory loss, soft hands. And I was literally this close to saying, this project isn't going to work in the way that I've thought about it. And as I simply sat there, I changed my kinds of questions. I said, tell me how you began. Tell me what your favorite stone is that you've done. And John went like this at a certain moment. And for me, again, there were two things. It was, I'm going to make their hands as I find them like monuments. That's going to be the foundation for me and what I'm doing. And it was the first indication. This is almost like a caliper that he's got in it. I mean, the degree, and even though it's soft, there's a certain attitude to it. John Hanna, when he started, the living masters who are American have the following characteristics. They all came out of mechanical drawing, industrial art. They all liked hand drawing as kids. And at some point, they stubbed their toe, metaphorically, on a piece of stone. So John's long-term memory was great. And he said, I'd come up to a Catholic school in Montpelier and saw granite along the road and decided that I wanted to become a sculptor. Trow and Holden in Barrie is the largest manufacturer of granite tools in the world. They're 100 years plus. He said, I had their catalog and I couldn't afford the tools, so I made my own tools for the first 5 years before I met Frank Gaylord. And when I made enough money, then I bought my own tools. Well, needless to say, in our world of smartphones and iPads and desktop computers, there's a big gap now. I've been talking about hands coming like this. In the current population of potential up-and-coming sculptors, the masters look and say, there are two or three guys who are in their late 30s who maybe in another 20 years will get somewhere. Because most of these are sculptors who acknowledge that it's only by the time they're 50 or 60 that they really got the swing going. So I left John Hanner buoyed by the idea of, I can go out and photograph hands and this is going to be great. And I had my first show at the Vermont Granite Museum in fall of 2008. It featured, actually both of these pieces are in the exhibit. And the Granite Museum is a 25,000 square foot granite shed, dirt floored, 40 feet high, bays where they were bringing in granite by railroad cars, do the blasting and go out. I was elated, and I was in the middle of a Rotary Club chicken barbecue, all right, with about 400 people eating chicken and not really interested in art. And that kind of deflated me a little bit. To back up just a moment to show you, the other great deflation is I'm there and I've got this image up, and I really like the image. And I'm talking with one of the sculptors, and he says, oh, yeah, that's Eric's hands. And he says it so nonchalantly, I'm saying, how do you know? He said, it's really simple. You see the thumb? We all know who each other is by the degree of brokenness and the way the thumb has been smashed and hit repeatedly. Right? So I'm in the chicken barbecue, and into it comes... Yes. The state art curator, David Schutz, from Montpellier. And he'd never been in the museum. He'd read the article on me about taking these photographs. And again, this was just a tiny portion at that time. And he said, no one's ever given attention to the sculptors of Barry and granite. I'm going to give you 3 months in this coming summer at the state capitol. So this is a single image. Their dining area is really resplendent because, quite naturally, it's all got granite all the way around the walls. And it was here that I first came up with the title, Give Me Your Hands, the Barry Sculptors and Their Stone. The difference between then and today is one word. It's the addition of the word legacy. Give Me Your Hands, the legacy of the Barry Sculptors and Their Stone. Because that's really what this is about. Of how what is left and how it maintains. I also had, at the same time, an exhibition at Soho Photo in Tribeca, New York, where I had one room for my Cape Ann photography and one room for the sculptors of Barry. And this was encouraging. People who knew nothing about it loved it and kept me going. So I would go back, and I discovered that the ambiance of Hope Cemetery is that it was laid out as a walking garden cemetery. And it was the tradition for particularly the Italians to go to church on Sunday, pack a lunch, go to the family plot, and then after talking over their past relatives, walk around and critique art and look at the most recent stones. So as part of the lecture last fall, the director said, you know, there's this extraordinary rose in Hope Cemetery. It's the rose by which all other roses are compared. So I went, I said, oh, I've got it. I know the one. And she said, no, that's not it. I said, that's okay, but that's not the one. Okay. So this represents the type of typical bas-relief rose carved into stone up in the air. Okay? It's the Berini rose. And the daringness in what you're looking at is this presents the idea of the family simply coming and laying a rose down by the graveside. And take a look at what's going on. You've got to go back here for a minute. You're looking at a flat slab of granite that's had at least 6 inches above it completely taken down to get to this one piece. This is not glued on. This is part of the stone itself. And this is the one that the Italians would say, this is a rose. That one over there, that's a cabbage. Okay. I had 15 minutes with Frank Gaylord. I was introduced to him by one of his students who was greatly shaken to see what Frank looked like. And Frank was in a one-room living facility. Didn't really know who I was, which didn't really matter. And again, the magnitude of his being and his love of stone, it just comes through again. You know, when a sculptor moves his hands, there's a pause. It's never part of just talking and gesturing in that way. So that led me to being sensitive to other parts of the story. I'd done all these photographs in the quarries, and I went into the boom derrick operator's shed, which had been abandoned. And what you're looking at on the left are the gloves that were hung up in 1994, the day before the quarry closed. The fluorescent green-yellow is from the grease bucket that the boom derrick operator had dipped his gloves into and greased the gearing of the machinery behind this on the right. And they had simply been pegged up for 14 years. And I went in and said, this is very representative. So I had an art show back in Cape Ann last weekend. And this is up large, as it is here in the exhibition. And a woman came in with her young daughter, who was maybe six. And she said, well, my daughter really is getting into being a writer. So I said, well, tell me the story of these gloves. What do you think the story is? She looked at them for about a minute, and she said, they're ordinary. And I've decided I really like that, the emblematicness of they're just ordinary. There's a story behind it, as there is behind the sculptors. But the word ordinary, which we kind of tend to blow by, it's like, slow down, spend a little time with it. That's the story of the boom derrick operator's gloves. Well, these are the hands of Jerry Williams, who is the pupil of Frank Gaylord. And as the American sculptors come in and as Gaylord teaches people, we start to get monuments and commissions that are not strictly religious-based. People say, I want granite. Granite's going to last a long time. It weathers well. Jerry Williams did a sequence of about four giant teddy bears that were 8 feet high. Okay? This is one in early process. They were purchased by a very wealthy person in Texas with a big forest, and they had to be airlifted in by helicopter. They were just that kind of scale and magnitude in it. At the same time, there's some very traditional religious-based work. This is a photograph of a stone in Germany of the weeping woman on the tomb. Right. And when I met Eric Oberg, he was involved in the commission and the execution of this particular monument. What you're looking at here is a plaster model in the foreground, right, of what the commission is to be. Up on the top is the single piece of granite. Again, the commissions are very few. The willingness of people to work on a pre-need, the willingness of people to say, I want a model done. I want you to do it like this. Eric went and studied the woman who was still alive for a week with her husband to do a wireframe skeleton, to put clay on it, then the drapery, then to make the plaster cast. So this is the 1/4 model that was used to go up to point to get to the monument itself. This gives you an idea. And this was at the time that I photographed it. It was still in process. And this is one that you'd seen before of the closeness. For a sculptor, the most unwished for word, the most pornographic word is the word start. Because it means he's working on the monument and there is the start of a crack. And there's no way to use super glue. There's no way to go back. There is no edit undo. There is no cut and paste. There is no autocorrect. You know? And it brings it back to this extraordinary moment of here is the stone uncut, and the sculptor needs to begin. And what he begins with is this great intimacy and sense of design that he needs to carry through. And although he's doing it with great force, it has to be done with great delicacy as well. Again, just to look at this again for a moment. Again, it bears repeating in the back. This is a block that was 8 feet by 3 feet by 6 feet being carved. This leads us to Giuliano Cecchinelli, who is unique in that of all the stone sculptors, he's the only one that doesn't punch a time clock. He comes and goes as he wishes. Another view of his first piece that he did, it's not just the fact that this is high relief, it's the scale and magnitude of the flowers in relationship to the hands and the way the flowers actually come out over to the front of the hands. Now, he liked to do things on a whim, This is represented in the exhibit. It's Mr. Pickwick. You are looking at a single piece of granite that's about 8.5 feet high. He simply did this and had it on his home lawn for about 5 years before a library decided to buy it. Okay. He was in no hurry to sell it, which is why I did, many of the stones in Hope you'll find have got medallions or photographs of people. I just am so much in love with him in his studio that I wanted to give this kind of representative treatment, because he says, when I die, they close the door. There is no one to carry on the tradition. There are no other stone sculptors from Carrara coming over to Barry to work with Barry Granite. And we're about 10 minutes away from concluding here, and then we can chat questions. Okay? So I'm in his house, and I put the camera down, and we're talking, and I'm showing him photographs. And I say, may I take your photograph? He says, okay. So he's sitting like this. He says, do I have to keep my hands like this? No. So he goes to this. And it is the thought right in here, what these hands are holding. He goes from this into this explosive sequence of, you want to see hands, you want to see fingers, I'll show you hands. These hands have never had gloves on them in 50 years. The whole time he's not looking at me, he's looking at his hands through his hands. So the Italians who come in Hope Cemetery through the stones, those that have got ties on were socialists. Those who have carnations were anarchists. And, you know, there were moments where they cooperated, particularly in trying to get concessions from the owners. It was 1938 that the granite owners finally agreed with the workers. They agreed industry-wide to put in venting tubes into the sheds to take the dust away. The deal was that all the workers had to take $1 less per day in order for this to take place, which was an extraordinary reconciliation. So at the end of a day with Cecinelli, he says, you haven't asked me about my tie. Right? I say, okay, tell me the story. He says, when I was 65, he's now 68, he said, at 65, I decided I was worthy enough to wear a tie to work. Because actually, if you ever look at old photographs of quarry workers, they all wore suits. I thought it was the owners for a long time. I was saying, how are all these owners getting in the pictures? All the Italians would go with suits to work. All the stone cutters, they would suit, coat, and tie. He said, at the age of 65, I put the tie on and I went into the shed. It was my birthday. And all the workers thought it was a joke. And so the next day, they put a tie on. And then they took it off. And they said, Giuliano, you still got your tie on. Well, he said, I put it on. It's never coming off. So his attitude, the other piece on his lawn, it's a piece of broken granite. It's a little bit bigger than me, about this wide. He said, I decided that I just wanted to show people that you can make something out of nothing. And on his lawn is this little piece of granite. And you look at the profile, and then you look in the front. And here it is, a stone. I don't believe it's self-portraiture, but it's a stone cutter, stone carver, sculptor with his wife. And that's just sits there. I mean, he did this in his spare time. And this connects very much with Elia Corti, who was a master stone sculptor at the turn of the century. There's a great statue of Robert Burns on the Barry Historic Lawn. All the way around, there are four bas-reliefs that were done by Corti. All right? Corti, and this is the statue, this is considered to be one of the greatest stone sculptures in the United States of granite. All right? Primarily, what you're looking at is a single piece of granite where the great coat has been undercut by 2 or 3 feet in order to be able to be hanging out in the air away from the rest of it. Dangerous commission, no one would want to pay for it. Probably no one who would attempt to create it. So Corti does those panels, and in 1903, he's at the labor hall where the anarchists have come. There's going to be a big fight. Someone is supposed to get killed, and Corti accidentally gets shot and killed. And his brother does the major. This is a single piece of granite. It's about 10 feet high. And it was such an outpouring of grief that the master stone sculptors from across Vermont came to assist in the creation of the stone. And here you can see he had a bow tie because he was a socialist. Well, this leads us to right toward the end. And again, this is to remind you again that the hand of the sculptor, when he touches the stone, is a piece of art itself, or is reactive to this incredible moment in connection. This is on the wall in the exhibition, and this summarizes the difficulty of the sculptor to make a living. Margaret dies, turn of the century. Father goes to the sculptor and says, look, here's a photograph. If you make this sculpture perfect and exact, I'll pay you. If you don't, I'm not going to pay you. So on spec, from a single piece of granite, the sculptor does this. And this is in the Green Mountain Cemetery still. The mother weeps when she sees it. She just can't believe the degree of, you know, life in it. The father takes a magnifying glass going through it, and he gets all the way down to the left foot, and he says, you didn't button the last button on her spat. I'm not paying you. And the sculptor says, in broken English, look at the pick. Look at the pick. And in the photograph, the daughter had left the last button unbuttoned, and so he gets paid. Again, you know, of the 10,000 stones in the Barry Hope Cemetery, only two are signed by sculptors. This was an anonymous craft, an anonymous art. This is actually a photograph I took 2 weeks ago, but I wanted to include it because it really shows for me the liveliness in the rock and the stone that the sculptors are looking to bring out. It is a fact that when the... That's 1 o'clock? Oh, good, we're on target then. Okay, good. So I'm going to finish right here with where I began. 42 years ago, I went swimming in a quarry, and everybody was skinny dipping, and I was looking at the quarry walls, not at young ladies. Okay. And so I wrote a poem, and I came across the poem 2 weeks ago, and in it I found this line, any man taking up a stone shall have the privilege of finishing it. I had no idea where I found it. I Googled and found that it was an exact line from 1901 in the Congress reports on the attitude towards stone for people working with it. So I continue to focus on the hands of the sculptors as a great moment in time, and I feel like I've taken up a stone, and I hope I have the privilege and the time to finish with it. Thank you. So now I guess there's a little bit of time. We got some 15 minutes for questions or comments or any questions?
Floor is open.
Yes, Ron. The Marquette is that plaster. The clay model is small. It can be as small as this. Right? That's shown to the client. Client says, okay, that's the expression I want. The sculptor then uses pointers to make a plaster model that's basically going to be quarter size. And with it quarter size, this is from back in the times of the Romans, they have a set of calipers that allow them to measure points like a pantograph and go up in size to say, okay, this space here now becomes this space on the monument. So there's a real interactive process. Obviously, it's much more expensive. Right? In Giuliano's world, when you have that process, and as a sculptor, once you have the Marquette, you don't change the design. You don't want to give the client something new to think about. So there is this incredible, you have to fight the urge to be, they're creative, but they have to remain within a certain boundary. It is, in other words, a model to go by, a guide. Sometimes they might have been wooden Marquettes as well, depending. Architecturally, lots of times they were wooden. Yeah. Well, this is a huge step forward to be able to be here and really honored to be here. This talk, I actually started to give it last fall at the Union Hall. I was back in Barrie at another Granite Festival and Rotary Chicken Club thing about 6 weeks ago. I gave it to a group of 20 of my dearest friends 2 weeks ago. When I return, I'm giving it at the Rockport Art Association on November the 1st. And my plans are to see, I've always wished to have my art travel because I know the way that people react to the quarries. Now I'm seeing that this is a vehicle that allows me to do it and reach and broadcast a bigger group of either people who are directly interested in stone, but you know the affinity and the issue of how working with hands reflects will and dreams and aspirations. Much as I love technology, I've sat when I talk with these sculptors, we talk about technology that's 2,000 years old, and it's a technology preparing things for those who come. So my wish is to be able to have the show travel and to be able to continue to talk with it as it travels. And I'm seeing that. I'm as much as like being through that, I'm seeing it. It's not a closed window. You know. The website, Give Me Your Hands, we'll keep updates and have more on it. You know, I've done a small book. I'm going to expand the book. Because there are, it is a passion for me.
Mm-hmm. How much of the art on there is likely other than when you do some
items? Well, again, you know, granite comes in after the whole tradition of slate and marble. Okay. Much of it has to do with what the attitude of the town or city or village is toward the cemetery itself. What I mean by that is, the Barrie Cemetery, they have a group of about 35 people that scrub the stones regularly to keep them clean. Many of the sculptors don't like that. In the Green Mountain, they don't. The fact is, granite weathers the best, okay, and holds the best. So it's at the same time, it's more difficult to work with marble because it doesn't reflect light the way marble does. Right? So it's going to be... You're going to know if you're looking at a tombstone or a monument that's got a dense gray speckle to it, that's Barrie granite. And yes, there are many, many people that will, the phone orders come in from around the world still. It's just that the greatest bulk in Barrie now is through Rock of Ages, which is the one largest granite company in the United States doing stone. Their production facility is the size of 4 football fields. And much of the work is templated work. You know, it's why that thing with the rose, was sort of an extraordinary thing, because most of the time the roses are put up as part of the tombstone, part of the monument. Here's one that's just laid out in front. You know, one of the things Cecchinelli showed me was he showed me these 10 little stones. All they are is little stones in the ground, a little bit of flowers and dates and a name. He said, look, see the first one, 1880. Took 8 months to cut that. Family knew it. They were prepared for it. You see 60 years of life and death with 10 stones, and each stone is identical to the first because the family held to that tradition. Right? Is that kind of answering? I mean, it's you're going to see it by the quality is going to be by the denseness of the stone. And if it has any kind of, you know, the statue of Marguerite, they can make it floral, they can make it flimsy.
Are there a number of pieces that you might see that were by lesser known?
No, I mean, once the Barrie sculptors got there, most of their work was in terms of the Barrie area. They would go out and do religious work but on churches and other areas. They would be contracted out and go out. But what's unique about this pattern is the incredible concentration within this area in it. Of the two pieces that are signed, by the way, one was by a sculptor who signed a piece for someone else. One is a sculptor who signed his own piece and declared himself as being a supreme sculptor, okay, which got a lot of people upset with a lot of stories. Any other comments? Yes, Ron. No. No. It was known, even the Romans knew about it. Dust was dust. What was unique about it was the incredible concentration in the pits and then with the sculptors working with the stone in the sheds. Those who came knew it was called the Mad American disease because many of them went back. You know, they got homesick, and literally they would go back and they, you know, within a year they were drowning within their own blood because the silicosis goes in and it destroys, it scars the lung cells so they can't breathe in it. And so many other cultures and countries had it. For a long time, the owners said, it's because you are unhealthy, because you have unsanitary health practices that this is coming. It's tuberculosis. They shied away from it literally until 1938. And they shied away for a long time because they said, if he's not doing it, why should I do it? And it took a lot of pressure from the unions to finally have that come into pass. And again, that was in 1938, thereabouts. So it was known. It was the Italians came here, it was called the Potter's disease, too. I mean, it just worked. It was rampant. This happens to have just been the really, you know, actually, even in Rockport, as I've done research, when the Swedes came, that many people, they came at the age of 30 and they knew they were going to be dead by the age of 40, and they were. The average life expectancy for someone working in the quarries was 45 across the board. And so that left a lot of widows in Barrie. And by the turn of the century, over 50% of the women were making their living by sustaining themselves by running boarding houses for the quarry workers. This was at a time when the national average for boarding houses being run by women was less than 5%. And they were innovative. The Swedish widows formed health insurance funds for the Swedish workers. The Italians and Germans found a way to serve alcohol in the boarding houses, keep the boys happy. You know, I mean, it was a precarious existence because of the silicosis. Any other questions?
Thank you so much.
Thank you.